Tere, and welcome to History of Estonia podcast. Season 5, Episode 6. Interview with Professor Merrick Tom on the subject, What do Estonians remember of their past? I.e., not about Estonian history, but about Estonian Nemo history. Merrick Tom is the professor of cultural history at the School of Humanities in Tallinn University. He is a member of the Estonian Academy of Sciences and of Academia Europaea. Graduated in history and semiotics at the University of Tartu in 1998, he earned his master's degree in medieval studies from the École de Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris in 1999, and his doctorate in medieval history from Tallinn University in 2009. He is the editor-in-chief of the Estonian history journal Acta Historica Tallinnensia, and the editor of the Journal of Philosophy of History. His primary research fields are cultural history of medieval Europe, theory and history of historiography, digital history, and cultural memory studies. Author or co-author of 10 books, of 100 scholarly articles published in Estonian, English, German, and French, and editor of more than 30 collections of articles or special issues. Currently, Professor Tom is visiting Stanford University in California. Tere, and welcome to America and History of Estonia podcast, Professor Tom.
Tere, William, and thank you for having me.
Okay, let's start off with the questions. What is Nemo history, and how does it differ from traditional history?
Yeah, Nemo history is a concept that I've used in my work over the last 10-15 years, and it was coined originally in late 1990s by German historian Jan Assmann. And it's a still relatively new field of inquiry in humanities. But to explain it simply, I'd say that when traditional history is interested in the past for its own sake, in the factuality of the past, then Nemo history is interested in the actuality of the past. So not in the past for its own sake, but in its later impact and reception. So in this regard, Nemo historian studies the different, let's say, afterlife of historical events or historical persons of other phenomena. And sometimes the Nemo history is particularly useful if you want to make sense of certain historical events or persons that have become somehow very important for, let's say, national identity or for more generally in one's collective memory. So Nemo history is, I think, a new useful field of inquiry that helps us to go sometimes, you know, beyond these difficult questions of what really happened, the questions of our particular ways of construing the past, enable later communities and collectives to constitute and sustain themselves.
Thank you. How does the construction of national identity relate to Nemo history?
Yeah, I'd say that Nemo history is particularly useful, you know, platform in order to explore various manifestations and constructions of national identity, because very often, or even always, national identity is built on a certain vision of the past, that national identity stems from some glorious events in the past or some heroes of the past. Mm-hmm. And there is no nation that doesn't cherish or celebrate its heroic or sometimes traumatic past. Right. And Nemo history helps to critically analyze how this national understanding of the past happens, how it is constructed. And in my own case, I use the concept and approach of Nemo history mostly in order to make sense of the Estonian national identity building, how Estonians have constructed certain collective vision of the past and how various historical events and persons justify certain decisions in the present, or how they legitimize certain acts or actions. And therefore, yes, I think Nemo history in this regard is a methodological tool in order to scrutinize the process of nation building.
Interesting. What do Estonians remember of their past, i.e., what is the logic of national cultural memory in Estonia?
This is indeed a question I've been struggling with over the last few years. And in other words, what is the mnemohistory of Estonian nation? And in my own work, I've mostly focused on the importance of narrative in the workings of cultural memory. And I probably should here define the concept of cultural memory, because in a way, one could also say that mnemohistory is the historical study of cultural memory. And cultural memory is very close to this concept of collective memory. In other words, every group, including nation, has a certain reusable body of texts and images and rituals, which valorization and cultivation helps to sustain the community, helps to sustain certain self-understanding, self-image of this group or society. And also, I mean, it is interesting to explore what is the structure of culture memory in Estonia. And yes, as I said, I've been interested in mostly in the narrative logic of Estonian culture memory. And the point of departure is very simple. I think narrative is one of the most powerful cultural tools of remembering, because narrative, and especially have in mind this kind of narrative templates or narrative patterns, these are very useful in order to gather a great amount of information into a single simple idea. And this argument has been mostly explained and developed by American cultural psychologist James Verge. And he has, for instance, studied what are the main narrative templates in Russian cultural memory. And as I think demonstrated very well, that most of Russian cultural memory is based on the narrative template of the expulsion of the foreign enemy. Mm-hmm. And indeed, if you look at various school books or history textbooks and other kind of general surveys of Russian history, they are often reduced to the simple idea that Russia has always been surrounded by foreign enemies and Russians have to fight and even be aggressive in order to protect themselves against the foreign enemies. And quite many of even most recent decisions in Russian foreign policy is kind of explained by this very simple narrative, that there's the kind of collective feeling of being surrounded by foreign enemies, and therefore we have to protect ourselves, even in a kind of aggressive way. And so I've been interested, what are the main narrative templates in Estonian culture memory? And one of my conclusions is that one of the key narrative templates in Estonian culture memory is what I call the narrative of the great battle for freedom. Mm-hmm. Because indeed, when we look at various Estonian historical textbooks and Estonian historical novels and films and different representations of the past, then we can see that very often they are based on this idea of freedom and independence and fight for this independence. Since the very early 13th century, with the fight against the German crusaders until the Second World War, either against the Nazi army or the Soviet army. So it's and very often, yes, Estonian history is reduced to this kind of great centuries-long battle for freedom and against Germans, or later against Russians. And again, this is not very innocent cultural tool, because as also James Verge argues, to a certain respect, to a certain extent, these narrative templates start to remember instead of us. So they start shape the way we make sense of our past. And they also, of course, create this idea of continuity and a certain coherence that we are a nation, a community that has always had the same sort of destiny of fighting for our freedom against foreign enemies. And so in this regard, when we ask what is the logic of Estonian cultural memory, I would say one of the logics is that we have been fighting for our freedom over the centuries and fighting it against foreign enemies.
Thank you. What is the role of literature and art in shaping cultural memory in Estonia?
Yes, this is interesting because as an historian, I tend to think that the Estonian cultural memory is mostly shaped by historians, by historical research, but actually it's not the case. And it's not the case in most of the countries. Because if you look more carefully, then this very narrative template that was explaining the great battle for freedom was not invented and conveyed mostly by historians, but by novelists and by poets and by artists. For instance, some of the key elements in this narrative templates, the key, let's say, fights or battles have been turned into critical elements of cultural memory by Estonian novelists. For instance, one of the mythical events in Estonian history is the so-called St. George Night Uprising, which took place in 1343. And we don't know next to nothing about this uprising because there is very little documental evidence about it.
Right.
And, however, this is considered often as one of the most important events in Estonian history, because this was an uprising of Estonian peasants against German landlords and against the Teutonic Order. And so it fits very well into this narrative that Estonians have been fighting for their freedom throughout their existence. And this very event was actually made known and popular thanks to a young Estonian novelist, Eduard Bornhöe, who published in 1880s one of the very first Estonian historical short stories or kind of short novel called Tasuja, the Avenger. And this book, which is a story about the St. George Night Rebellion, became particularly popular and is still widely read, even compulsory literature at the school. And so this very short novel written by a young novelist, I think he was like 18 years old back then, has very much shaped our understanding of what is the nature of the St. George uprising. And there are many other examples. I don't want to dwell long on this, but one can conclude easily that events that we consider, we Estonians in general, consider as the key events in Estonian history, are actually made immemorable and important and great mostly by various historical novelists, by poets, but also artists, because we shouldn't underestimate the importance of visual arts in shaping Estonian cultural memory, because some of these historical events and historical figures have been immortalized by great painters and graphists and other artists. And therefore, again, it is very important to understand that what we know about Estonian history, and more importantly, what we valorize about Estonian history, stems very much from the work of artists and writers, and probably much less from the work of historians, especially academic historians.
Thank you. What is the significance of the Estonian War of Independence in shaping the country's collective memory?
This is, especially from the Nemo historical point of view, the most important event in Estonian history, kind of culmination of Estonian history, as it were, because this narrative template of the great battle for freedom ended gloriously in a way by fighting and winning this war of independence. And again, I'm not now talking about the historical event, but more interested in the mnemo-historical dimension of the war of independence, And what makes this War of Independence so interesting from Nemo historical perspective is that, as we know, this war was between Estonians defending the country against Soviet Russia, against the Red Army. But in the collective and cultural memory of Estonians, we tend to think about the War of Independence as a war against Baltic Germans, because the National Victory Day, official Victory Day of Estonia, that celebrates the glorious winning of the War of Independence, is on the 23rd of June. And this day celebrates the famous Tsesis Battle, or Võnnu Battle, mm-hmm. that took place in the 23rd of June in 1919. And this was indeed a battle between Estonians and the Baltic Territorial Army, the so-called Baltische Landeswehr. And let's say, from a military perspective, this was a rather secondary event in the war that was, you know, against Soviet Russia, not against Imperial Germany. However, in the collective memory, we cherish this particular victory over the Baltische Landeswehr because it fits much better into this narrative template, because this allows us to say that the centuries-long battle fight against Germans was finally, almost 700 years later, victoriously concluded. And we can see from different memories, recollections of people who were in fighting this Tsesis battle, that they indeed, in their minds, were very much fighting with the Teutonic Order Knights in some respect. I mean, they it was not just particular battle, but kind of trans-historical fight against the historical enemy, namely the Germany. So yes, now historically speaking, the War of Independence is an interesting phenomenon, and the fact that Estonia every year celebrates the Võnnu or Tsesis battle, and every year our president, our politicians make speeches about how important this victory was, is quite interesting, and even I'd say paradoxical.
Interesting. Thank you. What are the dynamics of memory politics in post-Soviet Estonia from the 1990s to the present day?
Yeah, now we're switching to, let's say, contemporary period. And of course, this is a long and complicated story, so probably not easy to explain in a few sentences. But let me try to outline a few key aspects. First and foremost, memory politics in late 80s and in the 90s was probably the most important aspect of politics in general. And most of the political leaders at the time were historians who were very aware of the importance of memory politics. Then maybe secondly, the key word at this period in all levels was restoration. So the Estonian re-independence is about restoring, not establishing a new state, but restoring a pre-war Republic of Estonia. So of course, restoring immediately is closely connected to the idea of memory politics, because we wanted to restore everything as it used to be before the Second World War. We wanted to restore all institutions. We wanted to restore all the street names. We wanted to restore even the general conception of history. We wanted to restore university faculties. Everything has to be restored. So it was a kind of immense search for lost time. So in this regard, yeah, memory politics was important. And maybe the third aspect I would like to underline is the idea of rehabilitation, which is paired, of course, with the concept of repression. So the memory politics in these re-independence years was very much about rehabilitating all the repressed persons during the Soviet, but also Nazi period. So much of the memory politics was actually about transitional justice. in the sense that it was about creating a legislative basis to restore property to people who were, you know, deported or killed or who had to go to exile, and to restore their rights, etc., etc. So it was very much about like the return of the repressed, to paraphrase or to refer to Sigmund Freud, that was shaping the memory politics at the time. And I would maybe, because it's there is a clear dynamics in this memory politics. So I'd say that in the late 80s and early 90s, it was kind of formative period of memory politics. It was very much from bottom to up. It was local. It was, you know, many initiatives were taken by people, for instance, in restoring various pre-war monuments. But then, let's say, since the mid-1990s, the memory politics became more institutionalized, more from top to town, in a way. For instance, various memory political institutions were established, such as in 1998, International Commission for Investigating the Crimes Against Humanity in Estonia, which 10 years later was transformed into an Estonian Memory Institute, which is still existing. And so there was a lot of different institutionalized forms of memory politics. And last not least, the memory politics of late 80s and 90s was also very much about, I would call it the monument politics. So it meant that very many Soviet monuments were toppled or removed or destroyed, and very many pre-war Estonian monuments were restored. So it was also kind of restoring the pre-war monumental landscape of Estonia and to kind of domesticate the monumental landscape and make it our own by erecting various monuments to celebrate the War of Independence, for instance.
What is the new era of awakening?
Yeah, this is a concept that I think was invented in 1987 by Estonian literary critic Rein Veidemann. But of course, it refers back to previous concept of the era of awakening that was launched in about mid-19th century. And this is actually quite widespread metaphor in various national movements. And it, of course, conveys an idea of a nation as something eternal that can be sometimes dormant and then can be awakened and then can, you know, flourish and then maybe go to sleep again. And so this idea of perennial nation that sometimes is awakened, active, and sometimes is dormant, which of course is a kind of mythical thinking, because nation is not something transhistorical. But yes, in mid-1990s and let's say in the second half of the 19th century, it referred to this first Estonian nation building process. It refers to this new self-awareness of being Estonian. And of course, this, area of awakening was the very foundation of the establishing of Estonian Republic in 1918. But yes, when the perestroika started in Russia and different movements and there was rapid changes in the social fabric, then there's some people in Estonia started to talk about the new area of awakening and arguing that we need a similar kind of national popular movement that confirms our identity as Estonians, that is kind of protects the importance of Estonian language. But I think it was also a very clever rhetorical tool to connect this new political movement, these new political debates with this 19th century predecessor, and to argue that actually these are somehow connected, that the new area of awakening is just almost necessary follow-up to the first area of awakening. And it was very popular and very successful metaphor, and we can still find it in history textbooks and even in the last academic general history of Estonia, yeah, this period is titled as the new area of awakening.
Interesting. Thank you. How can the significant role assumed by historians in restoring independence and leading the state be explained?
This is an interesting phenomenon. I even dedicated a study to this some years ago and called this phenomenon the Republic of Historians. Because indeed, in late 80s, early 90s, the majority of political leaders were initially trained as historians. And there is probably various explanations for this. My main element of explanation is that Estonian political independence movement, re-independence movement, was born out very much of the heritage protection movement, which started already, I would say, in early 1980s, so in still Soviet times. And this became very popular, this idea that we have to care about our material cultural heritage, that we have to take care of our buildings and churches and graveyards, and but also about our oral history, that we have to collect memories, etc. And so it was claimedly unpolitical, apolitical movement. It was about, you know, culture and heritage and history and memory, but actually it became quite quickly rather political. Because, of course, when you are protecting cultural or national heritage, then you end up protecting the nation. And indeed, if you read, for instance, various speeches in the gatherings of this national heritage protection movement, then we see that very early on, even in like 86, 87, people started to say that the ultimate heritage, the ultimate national heritage, is the Republic of Estonia. And right. When we have to restore churches and graveyards, we have to restore also this most important heritage, namely the Republic of Estonia. So in this regard, the very idea of restoring Estonian independence was closely connected to this idea of memory, of heritage, of restoration. And therefore historians, quite logically, played a major role in this process. And we had in early 90s in the situation where the president was historian, the prime minister was historian, the vice chair of the parliament was historian, and many ministers were historians. So the country was run by historians. And of course, it had certain implications in terms of the choice of various policies. I'm quite confident that the fact that the country was run mostly by historians explains this restoration ideology that was so prevalent at the time. The decision that, for instance, we have to restore property rights to every Estonian who was expropriated from his goods during the Second World War. And this meant that many people lost their homes because they had acquired it after the Second World War.
Right.
And many other political decisions that, you know, were, let's say, historically just, but maybe just socially unjust. And I wouldn't claim that this was kind of bad or wrong decision. This is not the question, but from my perspective, it's interesting to see to what extent the political decisions were shaped by historians and were legitimized by historical arguments.
Great, thank you. What was the importance of rebuilding or restoring the War of Independence monuments?
Yeah, as I said, the War of Independence plays a crucial role in Estonian culture memory, and therefore also in Estonian memory politics. And it was interesting to see, and I remember this personally because I was, you know, a teenager in 1980s, to what extent people enthusiastically and even spontaneously started to restore the War of Independence monuments. I would say since 1986, 87 already, so still again in the Soviet times. And it was, of course, illegal, and sometimes they failed, but there was some kind of eagerness to restore the monuments in order to restore to repair the historical injustice. So one has to keep in mind that after the victory in the War of Independence, there was almost a national campaign of erecting the monuments to the War of Independence. So in 1920s and 1930s, there was more than 100 War of Independence monuments erected across Estonia. And all of these, or almost all of these monuments, were destroyed by the Soviet leaders when Estonia was occupied, especially after 1994. And this was a kind of traumatic memory in Estonia, that our sort of memorial landscape was destroyed. So it was quite logical that when the first signs of freedom arrived to the country, people wanted to restore these War of Independence monuments. Right. And indeed, I would say over maybe 10 years period, from mid 80s to mid 90s, more than 100 War of Monuments of Independence were restored. Sometimes these monuments have been hidden, so they were just put again in the place. Sometimes some elements were preserved, so they reconstructed these monuments. Sometimes they just made new copies. Mm-hmm. This was kind of very important movement to restore this monumental landscape of Estonia from mid 80s to mid 90s. And maybe one peculiar episode is also part of this story, because there was a plan already in 1920s to erect the main monument to the War of Independence in the city center of Tallinn. And for various reasons, they failed it. They organized various architectural competitions, but either there was not enough, excellent projects, or there was a lack of resources. But yes, there was no War of Independence monument in Tallinn. And now, when the independence was regained, the decision was that now we have to build finally this major War of Independence monument in the city of center of Tallinn. And again, it took quite a long time, a lot of discussions. And finally, the monument was, I think, opened in 2008. 2009 in Tallinn, and it's still there. So that's maybe the culmination of this massive construction of the War of Independence monuments in Estonia.
Okay, and our final question: how do war memorials in Estonia become screens in which many of the blank spots of the 20th century are sharply contested?
Yes, you're using here two interesting metaphors, by the way, the monuments as screens and the blank spots of history. And I think, let's start with the last one first, because it is interesting, this metaphor of blank spots of history was widely used in 1980s, 1990s. And it was next to this Area of Awakening, the second, probably most popular metaphor at the time. And the idea was, yes, that we have to fill the blank spots of history, which again is a bit misleading metaphor, in the sense that actually these were not blank spots, but there were different versions of the history. So it was more about rewriting history, not filling blank spots. And of course, these previous versions were, Soviet ideologized versions of Estonian history's critical episodes, such as deportation or the Republic of Estonia, etc., etc. But this idea of blank spots was very popular, and still we can see it here and there in public discussions. But I do agree that memorials and monuments are kind of screens, because, or even mirrors, if you prefer, because as we know, monuments don't speak; they are just there, mm-hmm. And it's about us and the humans to kind of project our fears, our anxieties, but also our hopes, expectations to these monuments. So indeed, they work as a kind of screens or mirrors. And we see in monuments what we want to see. And everybody can interpret monuments in different ways. Of course, monuments also by their design, by their, you know, textual explanation somehow influence our reception, our interpretation, but still in many regards, all conflicts about monuments are not actually about monuments, but about people who have different interpretations of the past. And yes, in Estonia, we have witnessed quite many debates and discussions around monuments. Probably the most famous episode occurred in April 2007 around the so-called the Bronze Soldier Monument, mm-hmm. which was a monument, again, in the city center of Tallinn that was erected to celebrate the so-called liberation of Tallinn in 1944, which, of course, from Estonian perspective, was an occupation of Tallinn by Soviet army. And this monument was widely celebrated throughout the Soviet period. And after regaining the independence, the public opinion was that we have to remove it. But due to various political discussions, once again, the decision to remove it was made only in 2007. And this was, I would say, used or abused by various Russian or Russian-speaking community leaders and politicians, and also by Russian embassy in Estonia, to launch some kind of conflict around this monument. And it was very successful. So in April, there were two nights of massive riots in Tallinn protesting against the removal of this monument. Ever since, we have had some other smaller debates about monuments. For instance, last summer, the government decided to remove a so-called tank monument in Narva, which again celebrated the Great Patriotic War or the end of the Second World War. And currently, even recently, a government committee mapped all the existing Soviet monuments in Estonia, and they concluded that they are still in public space in Estonia. I think more than 250 Soviet monuments. And the decision is that most of them have to be removed, especially in the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which very much kind of reactualized the Soviet monuments once again. And right now there is still public discussion about, what should be done, what is the appropriate way of coping with this Soviet monumental legacy. And I'm one of those who believe that we don't have to erase and remove all monuments, but we should keep at least a few most interesting for historical, artistic reasons. So to use this as an example to teach history for future generations, because you cannot erase your past completely. Therefore, I think some political initiatives to get rid of all Russian Soviet symbols is an illusion. That's cannot never be achieved. But yes, so to conclude, the monuments still create some tensions in Estonia, and they still function as a kind of screens of various interpretations of history.
Wonderful. Thank you for appearing on the podcast, Professor Tom, and I hope you enjoy the remainder of your time at Stanford University.
Thank you. I will indeed. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Nagamist.
Nagamist.
I hope you enjoyed the music. The song was by Lena, and the title is Kogu Tudu Yuri Ust, or in English, all the truth about St. George's Night Uprising.